Well, good morning, and may I add my welcome to that of Paul, especially if you are visiting us for the first time today. This morning we continue our series entitled Songs in the Key of Life. The term cards are at the back. And in this series that we're doing, Songs in the Key of Life, we are walking through all five books of Psalms. And we are really trying to get a feel for each book, looking at different types of Psalms. So this morning, still in book one, we are turning our attention to Psalm 29, a psalm that perhaps doesn't get so much attention today. And maybe the reason that this psalm doesn't get so much attention is that the worldview of the writer of this psalm is so very different to ours. The challenge for us then is not really so much how can we blot out the bits of this psalm that don't seem very Christian or don't seem very churchy, but rather how can Psalm 29 speak its own message and address our Christian thinking and address our Christian spirituality. Psalm 29 is a hymn of praise to God for his awesome power. But as we'll see, it is written as a polemic. It is written as an attack against the religions that surround Israel. I wonder, as we read that psalm, as Josie read that psalm for us a moment ago, what do you think was the one word that hit you time and time and time again? Surely it was this word, this code word, Lord, the word the Lord in English. It appears 18 times in these 11 verses. The Lord, the Lord, the Lord. That is, in Hebrew, the name of Israel's God. The name of Israel's God, the name indeed of our God. Yahweh. Yahweh. Y-H-W-H. Yahweh. Y-H-W-H. It's perhaps the most important word to understand in the whole of the Old Testament. Yahweh, the Lord, that's his name. So this psalm is all about Yahweh. Yahweh's power. Yahweh's might. Yahweh's voice. And how Yahweh is supreme over the other so-called gods. Politically correct today to say that our God, Yahweh, is the biggest, our God is the best? Politically correct? Perhaps not. But that is precisely why I believe this psalm is so timely for us as a society. It is so timely for us as a church. Switch on your TV, pick up a newspaper, switch on the radio. What do you see? What do you hear? We see our own society languishing under the god of secularism, drip-fed the mantra, there are no absolutes. Except, of course, that one. What else do we see? In Iraq, in Syria, carnage. Carnage based ultimately on differences in what kind of God you believe in from the Quran and its traditions. To those in Iraq and Syria, to those in this country and in the Western world, to us in this church, Psalm 29 says, Yahweh is the one true God. Yahweh is the all-powerful, almighty God. Yahweh is the one and only creator of this universe. Yahweh. 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 Well, let's jump straight in to see how and to see why. At a risk of carving up the poetry, I've split the psalm into three sections. It might be a little bit technical this morning, but if you hang in there, we'll get to the application at the end. We begin with verses 1 and verses 2 with what I'm calling Yahweh's supremacy over gods. Yahweh's supremacy over gods. We read in our NIV Bibles the inscription, "A Psalm of David," which can either mean that King David himself wrote it or that it was written in a Davidic style. But perhaps a more important question than who wrote it is, how was this psalm used? How was this psalm used? Who was the user, if you like? And who were they addressing by using it? Well, it seems from the context that the user is an individual Israelite, maybe a Levite, a priest leading the community in praise. And who is being addressed? Well, indirectly, the whole Israelite community is being addressed and being taught and being told to praise, to ascribe greatness to Yahweh. But this psalm is quite unique in that directly those who are being addressed are, verse 1, the mighty ones. Did you notice that? The mighty ones. Not the sort of phrase that you and I go around saying, isn't it? The mighty ones. The mighty ones. Now, who on earth, or rather who in heaven, are the mighty ones? Well, those of you reading a more literal translation of the Bible may already be enlightened in your footnote. But for the rest of us, you'll find that as we look at different books of the Bible at Cambridge, sometimes our NIV translations, that's the ones that we have in the church, sometimes they are very helpful, like last month when we were trying to make some sort of grammatical sense out of 1 John into understandable English. But for Psalms, and especially for Psalm 29 in particular, where an understanding of the literal phrases and idioms in Hebrew do need to be preserved, maybe the NIV is not going to help us as much. For the mighty ones, elsewhere translated the heavenly beings or the divine beings, are literally in Hebrew sons of the gods. Sons of the gods. It sounds very strange to our ears, doesn't it? Sons of the gods. But what the writer is doing is he is taking a well-known idea amongst Israel's neighbours, particularly, if you know your geography, their Canaanite neighbours, and he is turning it around to say, actually, you should put your faith in Yahweh. The well-known idea, widely held in Egyptian and Canaanite and Sumerian theology, is that the fate of mankind is decided by a pantheon of different gods who sit around a table in the heavens debating what to do with mankind. This is known as the heavenly court metaphor. And if you're making notes, you can read aspects of it in the first two chapters of Job, in 2 Kings 22, and in Psalm 82, verse 1. But what the writer here seems to be saying is this. If we could get the PowerPoint back, you'd be able to see it a bit more clearly. To the extent that all the other nations have this idea that the gods sit around a table babbling what to do, about what to do. If you want to play that game, if you want to take up that worldview, let me give you a Yahweh-centric version. If you Canaanites and Egyptians think that there is a heavenly council, kind of UN style, he's saying, let me tell you something. If you believe that, all the other gods, in inverted commas, are actually being told, ascribe to Yahweh, O sons of gods. You are the gods. Ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. Ascribe to Yahweh the glory due his name. Bow low to Yahweh in his holy majesty. For Yahweh is the God of gods. He is the Lord of lords. He's not just one member of the UN Security Council like Britain is. He's not just one member of the United Kingdom like Scotland still is. He's not just one small voice. He's the creator and he's the dictator and he's the eternal life president of it all. Now, we know that we do not have a fully formed theology of heaven just from the Old Testament alone. For this particular metaphor, we'd do well to look at the New Testament's version. Remember when we looked at Revelation 4 and 5 earlier in the summer? The heavenly court at the end of time, where we, if you are a believer, where we, along with billions of other believers, are standing there in the court of heaven with the Lamb that was slain, Jesus Christ, the one who died to save us, on his throne at the center. That's where this metaphor ends up in the New Testament. But here in the Old Testament, as with many things, this metaphor is not quite as developed as that. Here in the Old Testament, the question remains as to whether these other gods, these sons of the gods, whether they do actually exist or not, and if they do, in what sense? Have you ever wondered that? Do other gods exist? Do they exist only in the minds of mankind? Are they just caring angels helping Yahweh in heaven? Are they fallen angels on earth? Are they demonic forces masquerading behind bits of wood, enticing worshippers away from the true God, Yahweh? Or does the word God here simply mean kings of the earth, living or dead? The answer? Well, we don't know. We can't be conclusive from this psalm alone. But what we can be clear about is that these sons of God, these divine beings, are portrayed here as subservient to Yahweh. They're the ones worshipping him. Verse 2, literally, bowing low to him in his holy majesty. Hold that thought. All the other so-called gods bowing down to Yahweh. Hold that as we consider why these sons of the gods should worship Yahweh, the one true and living God. And the answer that this psalm gives, it is because of Yahweh's, we could have the next slide, Yahweh's power in nature. Yahweh's power in nature. Perhaps I'll read these verses again. Maybe a more literal translation. Verses 3 to 4. Yahweh's voice was over the waters. The glorious God thundered. Yahweh over the mighty waters. Yahweh's voice was with power. Yahweh's voice was with majesty. Why should Yahweh be worshipped? Why should Yahweh be bowed before? Because he is the creator, and therefore he controls nature. Yahweh controls nature. Let me ask you, this seems like a bit of a strange question to a congregation in Britain. How does rain make you feel? How does rain make you feel? For some, you're thinking, good for the garden? Well, I suspect for most, when there's rain during what is supposedly called summer in this country, we feel a bit, well, under the weather. Now, there is such a thing as seasonal affective disorder, spelling the appropriate acronym SAD, discovered in the 1980s and thought to affect about 7% of people in Britain. Does rain turn your mood at all? Well, if it does, here's a revolutionary thought from Psalm 29. Rain, water from the sky, it should not make us sad, but it is actually a sign that at the beginning of time, Yahweh controlled the waters of creation. It seems very likely that verses 3 to 9 are written to set Yahweh over and against the Canaanite rain god Baal Hadad, as it were, a rival to be lord over the assembly of gods. But the author's saying, okay, at creation, who really controlled the water? Who really controlled the water? You Canaanites worship, and some of you Israelites are tempted to worship a god who specializes in rain. But I'll tell you, at the very beginning of time, verse 3, Yahweh was already over the cosmic waters of chaos that we've been looking at in Genesis this year, and in his power and in his majesty, verse 4, he spoke creation into being. So it's Yahweh who made the world, not Baal. Yahweh controls the physical waters of the earth, the rain, because he made them at creation. And equally, Yahweh controls the cosmic waters even today, the tumultuous forces that threaten order in life, political chaos, personal chaos. And that can be quite hard to believe sometimes, can't it? That Yahweh is in ultimate control of the world. We just look at Iraq, if we just look at Syria today, we just look even at the godlessness in our own country. But this psalm reminds us that because Yahweh is the creator, he is in ultimate charge of his world. And he's in ultimate charge of your life too. His voice is with power. His voice is with majesty. You see, it's not a soothing voice that calms you in the way that, I don't know, maybe Mariella Frostrop or Scarlett Johansson might on a sat-nav. But Yahweh's voice calms us precisely because it is the voice of the one who is in control, sovereign over the world and sovereign over your life if you believe in him. Maybe there are some here this morning who just need to hear that. God is in control of your life. He is in control. Well, from Yahweh's ruling in the past to Yahweh's ruling in the present, from verses 5 to 9, the Hebrew stops saying Yahweh was and starts saying Yahweh is. Yahweh's voice is breaking cedars. Yahweh is breaking up the cedars of Lebanon, making them jump like a calf, Lebanon and Syrian, like a young buffalo. Yahweh's voice is dividing flames of fire. Yahweh convulses the wilderness of Kadesh. Yahweh's voice makes deer convulse and strips forests. So now we're given a demonstration of Yahweh's power. Let me ask you another question. We've had the rain, but have you ever been caught up in a thunderstorm? A thunderstorm. We're supposed to imagine a powerful thunderstorm coming eastward from the Mediterranean, hitting land to the north in the mountains of Lebanon, and then sweeping down south through Israel, from Syrian Mount Hermon down to Kadesh in the south. Can you imagine that? This huge thunderstorm sweeping down through Israel. I must say, in this country, we don't really get violent thunderstorms, do we? I remember watching a tree come down in our back garden in the hurricane in 1987. But have you ever been in a storm where you've seen, verse 5, trees burnt up, forests stripped bare, wild animals convulsing in fright? I remember being in Thailand about 10 years ago and trying to find shelter from a tropical storm where the roads had turned to rivers and the trees were bending over at 30 degrees and dogs were in ballistic fits, shuddering from the deafening claps of thunder. But even that was just a tiny glimpse of the raw power of nature. But who controls nature? The teaching from this psalm is this. Whenever you hear or whenever you see a thunderstorm, there is no implication that it is an act of punishment from God, but a thunderstorm is but one more reminder that Yahweh rules. The commentator John Goldingay says the following: when thunder reverberates through the natural world on earth, it is an echo of Yahweh's thundering in the heavens and an aftershock of Yahweh's thundering at the beginning. Now, that's not primitive thinking, laughable to the 21st century scientific mind, but it is primitive in the sense that it reminds us of the creation, the primordial beginning of this world. You know, each week at church and each day in our homes, I hope we acknowledge that Yahweh is sovereign over all humanity. But this psalm tells us that more than that, there are vast swathes and aspects of Yahweh's world that are quite irrelevant to humanity and to which humanity is quite irrelevant. But even here, over nature, Yahweh is still sovereign. Yahweh rules. I once spent 2 weeks camping around the Namibian desert. Namibia is one of the least densely populated countries on earth. I saw miles and miles of uninhabited gravel plains and sand dunes going on as far as the eye could see, never touched by humanity. But even here, Yahweh is sovereign. Yahweh is sovereign. In the news earlier this year, our attention turned to the southern Indian Ocean, didn't it? One of the remotest parts of the planet. As rescuers searched for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. I must admit, until then, I'd never really given that much thought to the southern Indian Ocean. I wonder if you had. The contours of the seabed in the south of the Indian Ocean, the creatures, the sea creatures therein, probably never had contact whatsoever with the human race. But even here, Yahweh is sovereign. Yahweh is sovereign over all his creation. I wonder, how does that make you feel this morning? Are you assured? Does it make you revere your creator? So Yahweh's supremacy over the gods, justified by Yahweh's power demonstrated in nature. But now the scene changes yet again. And we see in the final three verses, Yahweh's eternal reign. Yahweh's eternal reign that Paul's helpfully already read for us twice this morning. Again, I'm going to read a literal translation starting at verse 9, the second half of verse 9. And in his palace, each one in it is saying, In honour, Yahweh took his seat over the flood, and Yahweh took his seat as king forever. May Yahweh give strength to his people. May Yahweh bless his people with peace. So now where are we? The context tells us that we're back in the heavens again, above the waters, in Yahweh's heavenly palace, rather than its earthly equivalent, the temple in Jerusalem. And we're back to the sons of the gods again. So what are they doing? Well, they're doing what verse 1 and verse 2 told them to do. And they're repeating in their own words, verse 3 and verse 4. Can we see? Each one in the heavenly palace is saying, in honour Yahweh took his seat over the flood, and Yahweh took his seat as king forever. If it were urban slang, they'd be saying, Yahweh, you da boss. They're saying, Yahweh, you're the king. You're the king over the cosmic waters. You're the creator, Yahweh. You are the king forever. You are the God of gods. So the idea is not merely that Yahweh is king, but that there was a specific moment in the past when Yahweh asserted authority over the flood, the waters of chaos, and the waters that might resist his sovereignty. But at that moment, Yahweh took his seat. That was, he sat on a throne. He was enthroned. He was recognized for what he has always been, king over this world. So the divine beings are speaking of creation as Yahweh's enthronement. They are recognizing his eternal kingship. They are recognizing his eternal sovereignty, even over themselves. But that's not all. It does seem that verse 11 is a continuation of the divine being's declaration. And incredibly, they say, may Yahweh give strength to Yahweh's people. These divine beings, these sons of the gods, are supposed to be sticking up for the different people groups that they represent on earth. But having recognized the strength and the power of Yahweh, the one true God, the only real God, all they can say is, the strength and honor that are yours, Yahweh, bless your people with it. Take your people, Israel, to their destiny. Bless your people with shalom, with well-being, with peace. Friends, this is quite a startling revelation for us. Because not only is Yahweh recognized as king forever by the other divine beings, but for us today, when we are tempted to think that other deities, other gods are more powerful than Yahweh, we read in this psalm that these deities themselves are arguing for Yahweh's blessing of his people rather than the people that they are supposed to represent. But the power of Yahweh is so great that even other divine beings, in whatever sense they exist, they recognize his kingship, his lordship, his supremacy. Even they recognize that Yahweh is the only real God. Well, as we come into land, we've seen that nature itself acknowledges that Yahweh is creator and that Yahweh is king forever. But even divine beings in heaven acknowledge that he is creator and that he is king forever. And friends, so should we. So should we. Imagine you're in ancient Israel and you read this psalm as part of your temple worship. Now, translate that into your own life tomorrow morning, whatever you'll be doing. Think about this time tomorrow. Like an ancient Israelite, in whatever we'll be doing, you and I may be tempted to give our honor and our strength over to an entity other than Yahweh. Maybe another heavenly being, maybe a political entity, maybe something that is demonic. Maybe we are tempted to give our strength and honour over to the secular agenda of our society. Maybe to the gods of money and sex and power. If that is so, this psalm says to each one of us here, our counterfeit gods will one day give their honour and their strength over to Yahweh. And if we are tempted to think that something in this world can overcome Yahweh, whether it's the rise of militant Islam, the rise of the secular state, it can't. Yahweh reigns supreme in this world, and he reigns supreme in your life. This morning we have been referring to Yahweh in the Old Testament, the God of Israel and the God of gods. But if you've never read the New Testament before, I suspect that the vast majority of us have, allow me to let you in for an outrageous surprise, a preposterous claim, the claim of the gospel writers, and especially of John's gospel. And it is this. I'm going to state it quite crudely and then just leave it with you. Yahweh is Jesus Christ. Yahweh is Jesus Christ. Yahweh is Jesus Christ. So really what we're saying is this. Relinquish your own honour and your own strength and recognise the honour and the strength of Jesus Christ, for it is Yahweh's. Don't keep strength and honour to yourself. Join the other divine beings and recognise ultimately Jesus Christ. Ascribe honour and strength to Jesus Christ. And in return, he gives you back strength. He gives you back shalom, peace. This week on your front line, in your neighbourhood, in your home, in your job, at your school, at your university, remember, only in Jesus Christ is there strength and honour. And yet his plan from the beginning was to lay aside his strength and was to lay aside his honour, to humble himself to death on the cross as a substitute for sinners and to rise again victorious. It is at the cross where Jesus Christ, Yahweh incarnate, where Jesus Christ made it possible to give strength and peace to you as you put your trust in him. Ultimately, that's where this psalm points. So as we come to a time of communion in a moment, let's spend a moment in silence thinking about what this means for each one of us.